Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the processes and politics of patronal systems. Then, what makes a social movement sustainable and successful in the 21st century? Last week, we began a two-part discussion with Henry Hale about his book, Patronal Politics. While many in the West decry the politics of the former Soviet Union countries as corrupt and anti-democratic, our guest argues that there are much better ways of understanding the processes and politics of patronal systems. Henry Hale is Associate Professor of Political Science and International Affairs and co-director of the Program on New Approaches to Research and Security in Eurasia. He's the author of Why Not Parties in Russia? Democracy, Federalism in the State, Developments in Russian Politics, and his latest, Patronal Politics. Welcome, Henry Hale. It's great to have you here on the Scholar's Circle. Your new book, Patronal Politics, you've essentially proposed this kind of new way of understanding events in the world that we have generally, in academia especially, called democratization, rising authoritarianism, or revolution. You think it's really actually part of a longer pattern. What are you getting at?
Yes, I think the general idea is that in countries where you have high levels of corruption, low rule of law, where so much of politics as well, for that matter, as many other aspects of life, is about personal connections, who you know, that sort of thing, politics tends to work differently than it does in the West, for example. And I think that has big implications for the trajectories of countries in terms of their regime type and where they're going and patterns of politics. And so one of the broader conclusions is that when you have this sort of social environment where everything really depends on who you know and the personal connections and pressures that are put on individuals to vote a particular way through these personal connections or rewards that might be doled out on an individual basis, what you tend to get is a kind of cycling in politics. And so you get situations where when personal connections are important to power in order to have any resources or to have protection from others who might threaten you, there tends to be a rally around the leader type effect that tends to facilitate people who want to establish a more authoritarian form of rule, who want to quash their opponents. But at the same time, these sorts of systems, which might be compared to a giant political machine of the Boss Tweed variety, are vulnerable to, in particular, succession crises. So when people start thinking that this leader, this big patron, might be on his or her way out, then kind of all hell breaks loose. People start thinking about the future, trying to identify who the next patron will be, and trying to get on that person's side, or trying to become that person, or trying to prevent your rival from becoming that person. And so that leads to a breakdown. That's where I think you see a lot of the major revolutions in countries like this. So I focus on the former Soviet world. So we have the color revolutions that were largely described in media as being the products primarily of mass uprisings and democratic yearnings in the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, Rose Revolution in Georgia, Tulip Revolution in Kyrgyzstan. But I think these actually have much more to do with succession politics at the top. It opens up space for popular opinion to get expressed through these protests. And then the succession process gets played out. You get a new leader. But then almost inevitably, you start getting the same kind of reconsolidation of a more authoritarian system as all these people try to seek out their own personal connections with the people who have power and who have access to resources, because you can't rely on rule of law or independent courts to protect your interests. So you have to have this personal connection. And so the result is then a return back to more authoritarian rule until you have the next wave, the next succession crisis, which then tends to lead to more tensions. And I think the main way, in the short run at least, that in these countries can avoid this sort of cycling is to try and just maintain a high degree of popular support by trying to provide things that people genuinely want. When that tends to be the case, it reduces the fragmentation effect and gives leaders more control over the succession process. But even so, succession, is very fraught with risk for these leaders. So I think that's it in a nutshell in terms of what I think the core nature of many societies in the world, in particular in the former Soviet bloc, is, and some of the implications for how politics works and how we might understand it.
You noted in the book that we call this, from the West, corruption. To the people living in this, it's really just the way things are. corruption, or what is considered corruption, varies from place to place. Like some might think our role of money in politics is corruption, whereas in the U.S., they consider it part of free speech.
Well, part of it has to do just with the technical definition, which is activities that are formally legalized generally are not called corrupt, at least by legalistic definition, you know, because if they're done above board and following the law, they can't be prosecuted. But those very same activities, if they are not protected by law, you know, might be considered corrupt in other societies. And I think that's very much the case, as you mentioned, with like lobbying or something like that in the United States. You know, these practices would be illegal in many European countries that prohibit that sort of thing. But I think more generally, the issue kind of goes back to this idea of what people expect other people to be doing. Because if you expect that everybody else is behaving in ways that we would consider to be corrupt, people are put in this situation whereby they have to, you know, make concrete choices about what to do and what's good and what's not. So, you know, one of the examples that I give in the book, you know, is about a, say, a member of parliament who his constituents might expect him to provide resources, right, to bring home pork. And if that legislator does not do that, he's a failure. But the only way for this legislator to bring back those resources might be to pay off people in the central government to try and get them to direct things his district's way. And so if he doesn't do this and stands up for his own morality, his own constituents not only, you know, might have a hard time, but they might be very upset at him for not doing his job. And those same resources will just be taken up by all the other people, right? All the other legislators who are playing ball, as it were. So from the perspective of that legislature, to actually get something good done for his district, which might involve very worthy things, building a university, paving the roads, building, you know, infrastructure to provide gas to poor regions, requires some sort of corrupt activities. And so it gets back to this issue of morality. In that situation, is that legislator really immoral to do that? Many people in those societies would say not, at the same time that they would think that the entire system is corrupt. So there's a great title of a book by Rasmus Karklins called The System Made Me Do It. And I think that there is some truth to that in the sense that when that kind of corrupt activity that we would call corrupt is so embedded, part of the problem is that at the individual level, it becomes rational and from a certain standpoint, arguably moral to go along with it. So the question then is how to, you know, for reform then, is how do we change this entire system? How do we get people to start expecting that there can actually be a change and have those new expectations become deeply enough and thoroughly enough embedded in the system or implanted that people actually will start to change their behavior? And I think, unfortunately, historically, it's been very difficult to do. And even in most Western countries, this has been a phenomenon that, you know, has become widespread beyond certain smaller communities, you know, by some research accounts, only in recent centuries. So it's a very difficult problem.
Two of the exceptions that you wrote about from the former Soviet countries were Ukraine and Moldova. What was unique in their situations?
Well, one of the major questions that the book seeks to address is, in this kind of highly patronalistic context, what impact do formal rules make? And in this particular case, I focus on constitutions as sets of formal rules. So do constitutions matter at all when you have societies where laws are regularly disregarded or at least aren't considered very important? And so one of the arguments of the book is that, in fact, they do matter. They just matter in a somewhat different way. And so in looking at the former Soviet space and looking at the different directions in which the regimes have gone, in general, where countries have had a constitution that gives the predominant power formally to a president, and, you know, these are not dictatorial laws. I mean, they're laws not unlike those of France, for example, you know, where you have a strong president. Those presidentialist constitutions tend to combine with the paternalistic context of society to basically make that president not only a president in law, but a chief patron, basically a machine boss, kind of as the person around whom all these other power networks in society try to orient themselves. And so those societies where you've had presidential systems like Russia have tended to see a trend towards authoritarianism, punctuated occasionally by great political turmoil surrounding moments of succession. But what makes countries like Ukraine and Moldova stand out, I think, is that they have had other types of constitutions. And so they're among the exceptions in the former Soviet space. So Ukraine has had presidentialist constitutions at certain points in its history, but at the points in time where it was most democratic, where you had the most open and freewheeling political competition, it had a form of constitution that had a president, but that president did not have dominating political power, that basically alongside the president, you also had a parliament which would directly elect a prime minister. And so you had two executive authorities. You had a president that had some executive powers, and then a prime minister that had other executive powers. And the key is when those powers are sufficient in both sides to balance themselves out. And so I think that's what we've seen in Ukraine, in at least for after the Orange Revolution, for example, between 2005 and 2010, was you had a pretty strong prime minister and a pretty strong president. Both sides at different points in time tried to usurp power, but neither side actually was able to dominate. And so, you'd have one attempt to grab power offset by an equal and opposite application of the same kinds of manipulative machine political tactics by the other side. And so the result was a kind of democracy where you had vigorous competition, freewheeling media because both sides controlled media. But it wasn't really a great democracy because these were still political machines duking it out. You didn't have like a great respect for the rule of law, which arguably you need for a democracy truly to be a well-functioning democracy. And I think that's one reason why average Ukrainians didn't think very much of this democracy. They liked the political openness, but they saw that it really wasn't getting anything done. They were being still manipulated by media on different sides, constant stalemates. So the country was unable to find a solution to a major economic crisis in 2008 and 2009, basically had gridlock, permanent gridlock there, until finally people got fed up and voted in a guy who came back to power and instituted a presidentialist constitution. Moldova is slightly different because there you have a constitution that was what I call parliamentarist. It's not my term. A lot of political science research would use that term. And basically what that means is that an elected parliament fills all executive offices. So there is a parliament and a prime minister, but both are elected only by the parliament. And so there's no direct opportunity for the population directly to elect a president, for example. But what that means is that you have more opportunities for opposition to find their way into parliament and influence who becomes president and influence who becomes prime minister. So it doesn't lead to the same degree of concentration of power and authoritarianism, I think, as does a presidentialist system like Russia's. So I think that's why we've seen more open politics in Moldova and especially Ukraine over the years than we have in countries like Russia or Kazakhstan or Azerbaijan.
When you compared the former Soviet states with other parts of the world, you said these are a useful baseline for understanding these patterns in real politics. How are they a baseline?
Basically, I'm trying to think about how do these countries that I've focused so much attention on, the former Soviet states, relate to the rest of the world? What can we assume that the types of these cyclic dynamics that I've talked about, these kind of cycles between authoritarianization and democratization, what does that have to tell us about how politics might work in the rest of the world? Can we assume that other paternalistic countries work differently? And I don't think we can say that the former Soviet countries, the lessons there can be just uncritically applied to the rest of the world. And part of the reason is because the former Soviet experience, right, the experience of, at least in the case of the Soviet Union, 70 years of communist rule altered these societies in ways that other societies haven't experienced. And I think part of what the communist experience did was kind of eliminate a lot of the other types of institutions that can affect politics. So concretely, you had a massive leveling of society. So landed interests, aristocracy, all of these kind of sources of inequality were largely wiped out by communist system. You had new forms of inequality start to emerge, but these were different. These weren't based in traditional inequalities, between an aristocracy, say, and a peasantry, but they had much more to do just with more contingent access to wealth. And so there was this kind of leveling of society. And plus, when the Communist Party collapsed, it really didn't leave much in its place. So, I mean, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, like, really actually collapsed. And so it left this almost institutional vacuum. And so what there were lots of small-level institutions. So, you know, party cells or individual fragments or factories that were disconnected from a larger whole. Whereas in other societies, I think of countries like in Africa, for example, when the colonists there left, there were still many of these older inequalities that were left in place. Oftentimes, what you had in African countries, for example, were independence movements that had managed to develop very strong appeals to a broad part of the population that were mobilized through a long struggle for independence. And that was just not the case in the former Soviet Union, where really it was a top-down disillusion that occurred, largely orchestrated by Mikhail Gorbachev himself. And so when the Communist Party dissolved, there hadn't even had time to be a major opposition movement to coalesce in opposition to it. And so that's what I mean by it kind of being a baseline, in the sense that when the Communist Party collapsed, to some degree, it was almost like a clean slate. You didn't have organized parties already in place. The only one that you had, the Communist Party, was gone. You didn't have massive inequalities of a structural kind in society that could frame a politics of left and right. And so that really left these societies with kind of pure patronal politics. It really just was almost a pure instance of kind of who you know matters, and just these things that structure politics, these left-right divides, really didn't matter as much in there as they did in other places. Whereas I think in countries like Africa, what you saw after colonial rule ended was a lot of times it was the resistance movement that took power and then were able to structure politics and control it in a way through these parties that just did not exist in the Soviet Union. So you had these other factors there, or you had these massive inequalities that would form a natural basis for labor movements or wealthy, parties of the wealthy that would structure politics in a way that it wasn't structured in the former Soviet Union. So I think that's why we see in the former Soviet Union just a lot of gyrating back and forth between authoritarianism and democratization, whereas in other parts of the world we tend to see somewhat stabler authoritarianism or more solid movements towards democracy, with some exceptions in both cases.
So what determines which direction a country goes? It sounds like you're saying common histories, like the history really matters, the institutions really matter. What else would you say?
Well, in the longer run, and this isn't something I can really support empirically in my book, but it's what I think. And I think there is some limited evidence for it in the former Soviet cases. I think economic development in the long run will definitely have an effect, just because once societies become wealthy enough, and if that wealth becomes at least reasonably equitably distributed so that there's not just one class of super poor and one class of super rich, people will start becoming less dependent on patrons for their day-to-day survival. And to the extent that becomes the case, they start becoming more capable of autonomous action, which makes it harder for authoritarian leaders to use the mechanisms of their rule. I mean, they can do this for a long time through various repressive means, but inevitably there are going to be crises of some kind or other, or moments of succession where a longtime leader gets old or is expected to leave office for some other reason. And I think at those moments then, when countries are more economically developed, it becomes much more likely that you're going to get some kind of democratic outcome more stabilized. The people at a certain point are going to say, you know what, I think overall having a strong rule of law is more important to me than getting that next payment, from the patron, because they start to have a bigger picture perspective, partly because their own day-to-day existence is less acutely dependent on these personalized relationships. And so I think that makes it possible for reform to happen. I mean, there is research in political science which indicates, at least at a broad level over time, that this is the case, that economic development, the more economically developed a country is, the more likely that any attempt to democratize a country will succeed. And so it doesn't mean that kind of there's a direct relationship between more development automatically translating into more democracy, but more development just means that if there is an attempt at democratization, it's more likely to succeed. And over time, these various crises and random events or the appearance of a certain leader, these random events tend to hit countries eventually. And so I do think that economic development is one of the greater hopes for all this to be overcome, for countries actually to achieve a more democratic outcome.
You have said in one space that this is very cyclical kind of pattern. And then in another space, you had said that this is part of a longer pattern. Do you mean that these cycles are also evolutionary towards something else?
I think that might be a good way of putting it. I think in the short to medium term, you know, maybe the terms of a generation, I think we're likely to see these kind of cycles of politics. But over time, as long as these cycles don't become so destructive that they prevent any significant economic growth, over time we're going to see, you might think of it as kind of the amplitude of the cycles narrow. The swings to authoritarianism become less pronounced, and the swings towards democracy may be more likely to stick, at least or hang on for a little longer. So it's a kind of a gyrating pattern, but over time there's a larger trend that probably tends to take place. We've had almost 25 years now since the USSR collapsed in 1991. We haven't seen this yet, so I do think this is a longer-term trend. Even though we've had substantial economic growth in some of the countries, although many of those years have been years of significant economic crisis, but I think it's possible that over the course of the next generation, the next 25 years perhaps, that we may start seeing a significant trend away from this politics. But again, it's hard to say. Right now, the trend in the region does not look good, including economically.
I imagine it could also trend the other way.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm an optimist by nature, thinking that, eventually countries are going to grow. But absolutely, if we see growth that is not very robust or even negative economic growth, especially if these countries wind up in a period of war, as we seem to see happening in Ukraine, these patterns could continue in principle indefinitely. So I don't see any necessary trend towards economic growth or democracy, although, you know, one would hope that, you know, leaders at least have enough vision to see that this is in their interest, which I think it is, to do that. I think one thing that some of the countries of the former Soviet bloc at least have in their favor is the proximity to the European Union. Of course, the European Union is struggling, and if it somehow dissolves or succumbs, I think that would be a major blow to, you know, the prospects for democratization in this region, because it really holds out some hope of these countries at least being able to share a little bit of the wealth of Europe, and gives them some extra incentive to try and minimize the worst aspects of this kind of patronal politics. And so some of those countries that are closest to Europe at least have that hope. And so that's another factor that I think can, you know, help these countries along. But again, I think it's a longer term phenomenon. We have some countries even in the European Union now, such as Bulgaria or Romania, that are highly patronalistic in their politics. And so, you know, they've managed to stay more or less democratic. And I think that has a lot to do with the influence of the European Union. But at the same time, you know, they have not radically transformed their societies. Progress in combating corruption, for example, has been quite low. There are no panaceas out there, unfortunately.
Henry Hale, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I enjoyed it.
Henry Hale is the Associate Professor of Political Science and International Affairs and co-director of the Program on New Approaches to Research and Security in Eurasia. He's the author of Why Not Parties in Russia? Democracy, Federalism in the State, Developments in Russian Politics, and his latest, Patronal Politics. When we come back, what sustains and empowers social movements? What destroys them? Up next, stay tuned.
Seven summits and I swam the seven seas, but the road I must travel, its end I cannot see. Well, I fought in the jungles and I fought in the streets,
but the road I must travel, its end I cannot see. But once I had a reason, don't know what it could be. And the road I must travel, its end I cannot see. Well, I sang to myself that I want to be free. But the road I must travel, its end I cannot see.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How have social movements changed in the 21st century, and have new communication technologies facilitated change? What makes some social movements sustainable and successful while others are more short-term? What is the future for social movements? With us are three experts. James Jasper is a professor of sociology at the City University of New York. His books include Protest, A Cultural Introduction to Social Movements, The Art of Moral Protest, and The Social Movements Reader. Anita Lacey also joins us. Anita Lacey is a senior lecturer at the University of Auckland. She's the co-author of Governing the Poor and Transnational Activism and Social Change. Todd Wolfson is also with us. He is a professor of journalism and media studies and the digital media coordinator for the MCIS program at Rutgers University. He's the author of Digital Rebellion and the co-author of The Great Refusal. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the three of you here. What I wanted to start with is a definition that distinguishes social movements from, say, protests or other acts to bring people together or make social change. Jim Jasper, would you like to start?
Protest is a major component of social movements. We call them protest movements, in fact. But social movements have a little bit more to them than individual protest events, marches and rallies and so on. They build up some organizations, they build up networks of people who know each other. So they persist over time, unlike, say, one particular rally or one particular occupation. So they bring a lot more depth to them, and they gather some resources that they can use. They rent buildings and so on. They take out ads. They do more than simply march down the street.
Can you give some examples that would help us to draw distinctions? What would be something that used protests but wouldn't be a social movement?
Let's look at the environmental movement, which is a good example. They use protests, they have Earth Day, they get people out into the street, but they also at the same time do a lot of legal work. They build up, they promote alternative energies. They do a lot of work that's not particularly protesting something, but actually trying to construct an alternative in a way. I think that's the best way to think about a social movement as opposed to a protest.
Anita Lacey?
I would agree with Jim. I think it's about the sustained nature of protest in a social movement, as well as that idea of a network of people coming together in a variety of activities. So you might have a single protest about, say, animal rights, but that protest would then be situated within a broader social movement. So it's quite difficult to separate the two. And often where we see a protest, if we dig, there's a social movement behind it, but not necessarily.
Todd Wolfson?
Yeah, I think they've really nailed. The place I would go to bring it to life would be right now, an example in the United States I think is very useful is the Black Lives Matter movement, which at first, when you first looked at it, it was a form of protest and resistance to a particular set of conditions that took place, you know, the shooting of Michael Brown and the lack of a grand jury conviction, and the same with Eric Garner in New York City. But as we've seen it grow, we've seen a set of sustained forms of resistance and organizations that are becoming the backbone of the movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, which also may change name. So just on MLK Day across the United States, you saw something called Reclaim MLK Day, which was a series of protests in multiple cities organized by different types of movement organizations. And I think that you see the transition from resistance and protest to, I think we're beginning to see what is a sustained social movement. So it's just a transitory moment that helps us outline some of what makes a movement distinct.
Do you get a sense of how 21st century social movements are different from those in the past?
Yes. In my research, I think what comes clear is that they're very different. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be parochial, but at least in the United States, historians are going to mark a set of historical kind of left-based action, the old left being the first half of the 20th century, the new left being the 60s and 70s, with the civil rights being a bridge between these two. And I think if you look at the ways movements were organized in those periods and push them up against what we've seen from, say, the Zapatistas in the late 90s through to the early 2000s and into the contemporary moment, you see a very different logic. Much more of a focus on prefigurative politics, much more of a focus on direct forms of democracy, a much more interlinked role of social media and networks. I would say, unfortunately, much less of a strong analysis of class and capitalism, but I think we've seen a very big transition in how social movements operate.
Jim Jasper.
I don't mean to disagree with Todd, but I think what we see is we have new media. We're doing new tools for doing the same things that social movements have always done. They've always built networks. They've always recruited people. Now they recruit people. They build those networks through the internet, through Facebook, I suppose, rather than going door to door canvassing or hanging out at the local bar to recruit people for the labor movement. But social movements have always been about pulling people together, attracting new people to the cause, getting the message out, coordinating activities through communication. Communications have improved gradually over time. The internet's the most recent. Cell phones are the most recent twist. But there was a big step forward in the 19th century when cheap newspapers were available to be distributed. So there's a long history of improving communications, improving coordination that social movements have taken advantage of.
Anita Lacey, would you agree?
I would agree. I think one of the changes has been a fluidity and a quicker means of assemblage and disorganization. So you see movements come together perhaps a little bit more quickly in response to events. But as Jim has said, this has always happened. So if perceived injustice occurred, then people would assemble and activate against that. But we're also more aware of it because of new media. So I think there both have been changes, particularly around how we communicate to protest and to be active and to network, as well as new media's role in reporting that both to activists but also non-activists.
With the role of new media, I see a couple things that are kind of opposing forces, it seems. One is that while there's removing part of the middle person, the journalist, so people can directly frame the movement the way they'd like to and articulate things the way they want, communicate with their network in the ways that they would like, at the same time, I wonder if there's a danger of what people are calling clicktivism, meaning this shallow form of participation that doesn't get people involved outside of clicking on their preferred petition. Todd Wolfson, what do you think about that?
I think you make a really good point. I want to mark one thing first, which is it's not so much social media that has changed social movements in contemporary moment. It's a logic of how activists operate, which is co-determined by social media. But if you look at the way the Communist Party of the United States of America or the AFL-CIO or the CIO in particular was organized in structures in the first half of the 20th century, and if you look at the way the Direct Action Network or the organizations at the core of the global social justice movement or even Occupy organize themselves and the social horizons they fight towards today, I think you see a sea change in the logic of activism that may have some parallelism to the social media, but isn't about social media per se. We shouldn't overstress social media, but that doesn't mean there hasn't been a change in how people think about what they're doing. And I do think there's a deep danger with, quote, clicktivism. I think that actually, if we look at social media, and we look at the movements in the last 20 years, what we see is an over-reliance on technology. And what that's led to is people with social and cultural capital tend to take a lead in these movements because they're the most proficient in technology. And so you see movements that are much more led by a white, middle-class, college-educated men who have proficiency in how to create computer programs or create a video, and also this other dangers of collectivism, that it's an easy way to engage but not a deep way to engage, which I think you were marking. I think both of those are real dangers that we're seeing emerge in contemporary activism because of the role of social media.
Tim Jasper?
I've taught courses on social movements probably for 30 years now, and it was just 3 or 4 years ago, for the first time, I had more men than women in the class. And I think this represents a shift away from movements about collective identity, women's movement, obviously, but also the LGBTQ sets of movements. Also movements like a lot of the environmental movement and animal rights, heavily dominated by women. And I think what the Occupy movement represents, especially, is a turn toward economic issues, economic injustice, and a much more belligerent, pugnacious, aggressive set of tactics, I think, that still to this day attract more men than women. So that's certainly a change in the last few years that I've noted.
What about the gendered aspect, Anita Lacey?
So I'm putting on my activist hat now, but I would say there's always been a tendency for the male ego warrior as opposed to the eco warrior, who sees activism as a forum in which to express perhaps a sense of ability to change and an ability to dominate, unfortunately. That's challenged, but not always effectively, and certainly over the last 20 years, so preceding Occupy, and this would go back to my own background in Australia. You know, we've been fighting male dominance within activist circles, both from, you know, the eco-anarchist circle, some even LGBTQ circles and counter-capital circles, that, yes, there is a dominance of some white young men who believe they've got the answers. And I think that's quite common in many Western activist circles. And I do agree that we've seen a shift after Occupy, perhaps in a heightened sense of the role of the male activist linked to technology, but of course not only about that role.
Yeah. I think that raises another question, which is the very purpose of social movements and the definitions of success. I've always argued that the civil rights movement is unparalleled in terms of success. They won laws, culture, identity. They changed the fabric of a nation on every level. And I haven't seen very many movements since then succeed. Maybe the marriage equality one is going there. But I think I saw, Jim Jasper, in your work that maybe this is not always the goal. Maybe this is not, what would you say defines success and the purpose of social movement?
I think most social movements are indeed trying to change public policy. On the other hand, most movements fail at that. As kind of a second best, they often turn to, well, we're going to influence culture, we're going to influence public attitudes, we're going to find smaller successes. Mobilizing the movement itself becomes a form of success. If we can mobilize a big movement, get a lot of people out, that's taken as a form of success, whatever the broader impact. Especially scholars who study social movements want to find success. They want to think that the movements they study are important. So they look around for all sorts of types of success to do so. The civil rights movement plays a big role in scholars' images of what a social movement is. Frankly, the civil rights movement is white, every white scholar's favorite movement. There's less consensus among black scholars who actually may not love the Martin Luther King blue-coated preachers movement of the SCLC, but for white Americans, this is the great movement where everybody came together. you could say that we still have a long way to go on race in America, especially as Tom mentioned with the Black Lives Matter movement. The civil rights issues come up again and again and again and have never gone away. As far as success, I think you're right. Same-sex marriage as a movement has been remarkably successful in a very short amount of time. I would say that the women's movement has also been incredibly successful in an even shorter length of time than we've had the civil rights movements. There certainly are successful movements. There are not enough of them, perhaps. What has happened also in the last generation is that it's really the right wing that has been more successful at mobilizing in the United States than people on the left liberal end of the spectrum. That's something that has changed a bit in the last few years. But since the 1970s, if you wanted to see really successful mobilization, it tended to be among the Christian religious right.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're discussing the evolution of social movements. Todd Wolfson, let's bring you in. You looked at some examples like indie media, which you think had lasting influence, but in the short term was sort of a failure. How would you assess social movement success?
I think James really marked some really excellent points about what success we've seen, and I agree that most of the time, the real goal is a change in policy, you know, a change that actually affects the lives of human beings who are, you know, being organized into movements or are doing the organizing. And all too often, we haven't seen that. And I looked at the global social justice movement, and what I tended to see was this tenuous balance between what we prefigurative politics, right? Changing the structures within the movement to resemble the kind of world you want to see, which often led to a set of obstacles that the activists who were often quite young didn't know how to deal with in actually enacting the change they wanted to see. And so there was a strong, certainly in indie media, there was a tension between living the world you want to see versus being able to build a strategy that enacts the change you want to see. And I think many times activists will then move very closely towards prefiguration because it's, I'm not going to say it's more comfortable, but it leads to a place where we could say, well, at least we didn't create structures of hierarchy or certain sort of gender dominance or et cetera, et cetera. So I don't think indie media was successful in creating the changes it aimed to enact, but I do think it was successful in other ways.
Anita Lacey.
I would agree with both of you that the movements I've looked at tend to be autonomous, small-scale movements and collectives as part of that global social justice network. And they're not necessarily seeking the sort of instrumental policy change in the immediate. And so success for them can simply be about a functioning, non-hierarchical collective and fostering that collective identity and the pursuit of a greater range of causes and building a network and perhaps slow change. But I also believe that we can mark successive movements by looking at more instrumental change, you know, policy change, and would agree that the three sort of success stories of the 20th century would probably also include a fourth, which could be the environmental movement, and of course a fifth, which would be the right, and they're ongoing. So their success has reached an end point because, you know, we don't live in a world free of racial injustice. We don't live in a world of no patriarchy, et cetera, but they have certainly reached a level of success.
Jim Jasper.
I think all social movements face a little bit of a trade-off between how much attention to pay to their own internal membership and their own internal functioning and how much attention and time to pay to other players out there, governments and media and the police and so on. And when things go bad for a movement, very often they sort of turn inward for a while and they spend a lot of time making their own members feel good about being members of the movement. But while that maintains their commitment, it also doesn't get anything done in the real world. So I think a lot of people who were frustrated with the Occupy movement were frustrated with it partly because of the General Assembly and the internal procedures. And, you know, it's a trade-off. It's a dilemma. There's no right answer. You need a little bit of both, the internal and the external.
Jim Jasper, you also wrote about the importance of meaning-making and emotions, and how do these come into play?
Emotions come in at all stages of a social movement. Emotions help people get involved, get recruited. It's the anger, the indignation they feel about some injustice in the world that is at the core of why they join social movements. But then there are other emotions. They may be afraid if they're intimidated by the police. They may be bored and stop coming to demonstrations for those reasons. They may simply be tired. It may be that the emotions they feel for their families. So emotions bring people into social movements as well as bringing them out again.
Anita Lacey?
I would agree. Obviously, emotions core, if we think about one of the core goals being our collective sense of belonging, or maybe it's not a goal, but it's certainly a mode of operation and can become a focus point of a movement. So obviously emotions and the way in which people communicate, the way in which people respond to difficult times, people's goals and aspirations and hopes, these are key, I think, to understanding social movements, and perhaps that there are different types of social movements with different ideas of success, different focuses, and probably going back to that point you made, Jim, about at some times movements will retreat and focus on an inner dynamic as opposed to their relationships with formal police and the state, etc. I do think it's important to recognize that there are some groups, some social movements that will never seek to engage with the state or police in the way that other groups might. So they don't see their goal as having a good functioning relationship with police or the state. So to me, that's one of the important sort of ideas about social movements, is that we don't try and judge them all against those formal policy-seeking sort of movements, this American civil rights movement, for example, and that even within that, there was, as you've said, a lot of dissent about how to operate, what the best modes of operation are, hierarchy, leadership, etc.
Or leaderlessness, as we saw in some of these movements that Todd Wolfson has been writing about. That leads me to another aspect, and Todd, you did a bit of this in your book, which is how these social movements learn from each other and how social media has expedited this ability to learn from one another, influence one another, and maybe even building more of a global solidarity. Todd Wolfson?
One thing I looked at in particular was the Zapatistas. So the Zapatista movement that started in 94 on the day the North American Free Trade Agreement went into effect.
Just for people who don't know, the Zapatistas, just say a little bit about Chiapas and Mexico and why they started.
Absolutely. So they emerged on the day the North American Free Trade Agreement went into effect. It was largely, though not entirely, Mayan peasants in the southernmost state of Mexico, Chiapas, which is one of the most resource-rich, but one of the poorest states. And they rose up because when the North American Free Trade Agreement went into effect, they said it was a death knell to their way of life as subsistence farmers, particularly because agribusiness in the United States and cheap corn would flood markets and make their way of living impossible. And so they rose up, they took over a host of towns and the capital of Chiapas on January 1st. And then there was an ensuing struggle between them and the Mexican state, which they honestly weren't fully prepared for. And they were retreating into the mountains, and the Mexican army was pursuing them when they turned to the internet in an interesting way, amongst other things, and they were able to get a peace accord. And there's a lot to that story that can be looked at, but I guess what I really wanted to understand was how the logic of the Zapatistas became a kind of a fundamental ideological stone in which the whole global social justice movement sort of kind of measured itself up against. And so many of the things that they kind of thought through, such as direct democracy, which has a long Mayan history, or networks, which were these, the way they kind of organized themselves in these caracoles or these communities that they lived in, or the role of social media, then became central concepts that activists in the global social justice movement utilized. And I would mark these ideas moved from Mexico northward, I would say largely, and then across to Europe as well. There's a problem with that, though, because land-based Mayan peasants developing a certain set of logics and then transferring those logics to a global, largely middle-class movement in the U.S. and Canada has serious problems, not to mention that people in North America took what I think was a very flexible strategy of the Zapatistas and turned it into orthodoxy. So people weren't like, it must be direct democracy at all times, when the Zapatistas had a mixture of a hierarchical army and democratic processes and communities. But I do think that the logics that emerged out of the Zapatistas were extremely influential on the global social justice movement, and I would say secondarily influential in the more recent wave of protests from the quote-unquote Arab Spring to Occupy.
And maybe then you saw an abundance of additional protests that have arisen in the 21st century, including Hong Kong calling themselves Occupy. Anita Lacey?
I think what we can take from looking at the role of networks, particularly in the on Cuantros and the meetings around the Zapatista struggle and in solidarity with the Zapatista struggle and also a larger network of anti-neoliberal struggles, is something that recognizes a long-standing history of networking and newer forms of. And I think this goes back to the earlier point of overstating the role of new media, because we can see that the internet played a really fundamental role in the 1990s in the global social justice movement. But it didn't organize people. It wasn't the only tool that brought people together. What brought people together was a sense of urgency around free trade agreements, urgency around global poverty and social injustice, and a sort of connection with each other globally, but of course also built around the local. And we saw a momentum emerge from the early 1990s right through to 2001, when, of course, things fundamentally changed and we entered into a counter-terror period, but also an anti-war period. And so those networks were then built on and changed again, building on the local and a sense of global. One of my points of interest in looking at this period is the role of the Global South and how we took a movement from Mexico. It quickly became quite North-dominated, but led to really interesting relationships between activists in the Global North with activists from the Global South. So things like the Intercontinental Caravan that brought activists from India to Britain to look at the legacy of colonialism on trade relations, but also how to forge a more inclusive global social movement. And I think those questions still remain. I think there's a lot of work to be done. And I think the example of Occupy Hong Kong really reminds me of just how sort of both problematic and hopeful this is, you know, that we see students taking this label, literally direct occupying the street in this strange sort of place of post-colonialism and new colonialism, but that we need critical reflection at all times about how we're using these labels, how we ascribe success to new social media and new media, given lack of access in a global sense to this new media as a sort of forum and mechanism of organizing.
Okay. Really important points. Jim Jasper.
Well, I think the global justice movement is a great example that shows why or how new technologies and good old-fashioned face-to-face networking and meetings always work together. There's a lot of new media that were used to, in the end, bring people to the World Social Forums, 100,000, 150,000 people. They weren't satisfied with staying at home and Skyping with each other. There's an energy you get from being together in the same place at the same time. The same with North Africa, with Tunisia and Egypt. You don't bring down governments until you go out into the streets. You can use Facebook and new media to coordinate those gatherings. But in the end, you've got to bring people together.
Todd Wolfson?
I completely agree with Jim, and I think those are really important statements. And I think, for instance, the indie media movements, one of the reasons it didn't operate well in the long term was because of an over-reliance on technology that moved away from the local and moved away from the streets. One other thing I guess I would mark is I think there needs to be a balance moving forward between the meme around leaderlessness and a belief in building leaders. And by that I mean that in order to build movements, I think the ones that have been most successful have been committed to programs where people do political education together, they get clear, competent, committed, and connected. And these sort of things are very hard to build in movements that are fearful of leadership and want to lead with the meme of leaderlessness. And so it's something we really need to balance moving forward, because leaderlessness, I think, once again, tends to favor those with the most social and cultural capital, and also doesn't bring all of us up into a movement and build the skills to help lead that movement. So it's an important question I think we need to tackle moving forward.
Anything you'd like to add, Anita?
I just concur with both Jim and Todd and say that I think we're going to see a lot of ongoing activism and potentially new networks between race, climate, and poverty. I mean, this is the global social justice movement's moment, just as it has been previously, but that perhaps we will see new networks and coalitions of activists around the ways in which these issues intersect in very powerful ways. But it will take place through a combination of new media, but essentially also on the street.
Let me thank the three of you, Anita Lacey, James Jasper, Todd Wolfson. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar's Circle. James Jasper is a professor of sociology at the City University of New York. His books include Protest, A Cultural Introduction to Social Movements, The Art of Moral Protest, and The Social Movements Reader. Anita Lacey is a senior lecturer at the University of Auckland. She's the co-author of Governing the Poor and Transnational Activism and Social Change. Todd Wolfson is professor of journalism and media studies and the digital media coordinator for the MCIS program at Rutgers University. He's the author of Digital Rebellion and the co-author of The Great Refusal. Thanks to all who made this program possible: Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Cuauhtemoc Aleman, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Armudian. See you next week.
So I counted my misfortunes. I added up the blame. I picked through all the garbage. I checked off all the names. I read in the newspaper. They questioned all my friends. They hoped that they could find my ass before I struck again. So I sang to myself that I wanna be free, but the road I must travel.